We are currently, we'll be picking up in chapter 9 and verse 15 in just a moment. Back that off a little bit. Chapter 9, at least in my mind, is where the Hebrew writer begins to bring together a number of these threads that he has established in the earlier part of the book, and really show how the various arguments he has made about the superiority of Christ all come together in him. And so Hebrews is a master class in inspired systematic theology, literally inspired systematic theology. The Hebrew writer is pulling together all kinds of, not only threads in the book of Hebrews, but threads from throughout the Old Testament as he expands upon the various Old Testament themes that again come together in sharp focus in the person and work of Jesus Christ as King, as priest, as prophet, as sacrifice. And so all of these things are coming together, and we'll try and tie some of that in. So with that in mind, let's briefly remember some of these threads from the book of Hebrews as we're moving up to the text we'll be studying this morning. We saw that Jesus as the final deliverer of God's word, the last word from God, and as the one who possesses all the attributes of divinity, who is himself God, he came, and he has a name better than the angels. Better than the angels because they have never been designated to be a king over God's people the way that Jesus has. And he cites Psalm 2:7 and a number of other, 2 Samuel 7 and a number of other passages to support that. And because he is a superior messenger, he has a superior message. And so his law, his message is greater than the one in the Old Testament. And if they thought that it was necessary to listen to that message, the Old Testament message, then it is that much more necessary to listen to the last word from God in the person and message of Jesus Christ. He is superior to Moses. Moses was a servant in God's house. Jesus is a son. Moses was a part of God's house. Jesus is the one who built the house. And as such, he gives them a greater rest. Joshua led them into the land. Jesus leads them into an eternal rest, into the very rest of God, the very rest that God entered into on the seventh day. That is the rest that Jesus holds out for his people. He is a greater high priest, and that's the argument that we're really in the throes of now. He argues that he is sympathetic to us in a way that the old priest could not be, because he is familiar with our weaknesses, but he is gone through those things without sin. And then we talked about in 5 and 6 that he encourages them not to drift away, but to remain faithful, and expresses confidence that they will, in fact, remain faithful before rejoining his argument and comparing Jesus to Melchizedek. And Melchizedek is greater than Abraham, and therefore greater than Levi and Aaron, because they were in Abraham's loins when Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek, and Melchizedek blessed Abraham. Therefore, Abraham is inferior to Melchizedek, Jesus is a priest after the order of Melchizedek. It's a greater priesthood. As a result of him being a greater priest, he has a greater sacrifice and establishes a greater covenant. And we're going to say a good bit about that and go back and look at chapter 8 when we get to that. In chapter 9, we'll reflect back on some of those arguments. So I'm going to leave that for now. Let's sort of pick up in chapter 9. This whole argument begins in chapter 9 based on the ordinances that went on in the tabernacle. And the message of the tabernacle, according to the Hebrew writer, the message that the Holy Spirit is trying to convey to those people is what? What does all this say about their ability to come into the presence of God? They can't. That's exactly right. And the Holy Spirit is signifying this. Hebrews 9:8. The Holy Spirit is signifying this, that the way into the holy place has not been disclosed while the outer tabernacle is still standing. So as long as this, and we might argue, or something like this, is in place, then that's a plain indication that people cannot come into the presence of God. I want to ask something. Would it have been possible for Temple Judaism to go on continuously alongside of Christianity? No, I'm getting no's. Why? I agree with you, but why? Where does the tabernacle come from? God. Okay, and so the tabernacle is a message from God about man's condition before God. And so this had to be taken out of the way in fairly close proximity to the coming of Christ. Otherwise, you've got mixed messages from heaven. Does that make sense? That you have one message that the way into the holy place has not yet been made manifest, and you have another message the way into the holy place has been made manifest. You've got conflicting messages. And since the tabernacle is not, it's not an invention of men, it was made after the pattern shown to Moses on the mountain, it had to be taken out of the way. It's not just that God got rid of the temple so people wouldn't think we're still under the old covenant. I think that's true, but that's just a narrow part. This had a very specific message. It said very specific things to God's people about their relationship with Him and the state of that relationship. And that message cannot exist alongside the message of Jesus Christ for any lengthy period of time because they're two different messages. Jesus says the way into the holy place has been made manifest. The tabernacle says, or the temple later says, the way into the holy place has not been made manifest. And so, those are two different messages. You can't. There was an overlap, I think necessarily, an overlap, but those things cannot stand simultaneously, continuously, because they're completely. Completely different messages. Does that make sense? Okay. Nobody's saying anything. So you think about that. Okay. The same people who said it can't continue to stand are the ones that stand. You're already there. Okay. So he talks about these things, and we talked about how the high priest entering into the holy place once a year on the Day of Atonement is at the heart of this argument that he's making. And that is the thing that signified to the people that the problem of sin was not taken care of, because he did it again year after year after year after year after year. And there's a reminder of sins year after year. And he also makes the point in 9 and 10 that kind of 9 through 11, that these things have to do only with outward cleansing. And we talked some about the things that he refers to. So Leviticus 16, the law concerning the Day of Atonement, comes on the heels of Leviticus 11 through 15, which deals with food laws, impurity as a result of childbirth, Leviticus 12, leprosy, Leviticus 13 and 14, and then bodily emissions, Leviticus 15. And so all of those are what? They're outward. They're outward manifestations of cleanness or uncleanness. They have to do with physical things and not the conscience. Okay? And so there's this lesson about sacrifice being necessary to cleanse God's people, but it's all outward. It was a picture. It was an acted parable of a deeper reality. And he says in verse 10, they relate only to food and drink and various washings and regulations for the body imposed until the time of reformation. That is, until the time that Christ comes. But when Christ came, he doesn't enter into the tabernacle that the Levites entered into. Which tabernacle does he enter into? The real one. The one in heaven, into the very presence of God. And so it's not just Numbers 19 talks about the red heifer. You know, they take a red heifer out and they would spill its blood, and they'd take the blood and they'd sprinkle it toward the tabernacle. They're outside the camp. They're not at the tabernacle. They're outside the camp. They sprinkle it toward the tabernacle seven times. And then they would burn the heifer and the blood and everything else. And they would keep the ashes from the burned heifer near water. And they would, when somebody needed to be cleansed, they would take some of the water and then put the ashes in it and they cleanse them. Again, it's an outward cleansing ceremony. And that was cleansing for things like someone who'd come in contact with a dead body. Okay, again, Numbers 19 specifies some of the use of these things. But it's outward cleansing. It doesn't take care of the problem of sin. It's a picture. It pictures a need for people to be cleansed before they come into the presence of God. It points to something greater. The Hebrew writer, that's where he's directing our attention. But Jesus entered the greater, more perfect tabernacle, and not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood. And we talked about last time that goats and calves are not, they're not sentient. They're not offering themselves according to their own will. They are neither sinners nor sinless. Because they're not, none of that stuff applies. And so, again, they're not adequate. It's not, in some sense, it's apples and oranges. The problem of sin and the sacrifices that were offered in response to those sins are not, they don't correspond. Okay? The wages of sin is death. But the death of an animal is not an adequate substitute for the death of man. Because the consequences of sin are eternal and not temporal. And so there had to be an eternal and willing sacrifice offered. And so we're told in verse 14 that he says, "How much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God?" Now, there's an important distinction we talked about last time there, that the sacrifices and the washings in the Old Testament, where was the cleansing going on? Inside or outside? Outside. Where is the real problem, according to Jesus in Matthew 15? It's on the inside. It's a problem of the heart. And Jesus is able to cleanse the conscience. He's able to take care of the problem. He's an adequate sacrifice. And so people can know that their sins have truly been taken care of. They've truly been redeemed. And then in 15, he begins to get in. This is where we left off. He begins to get into the actual significance of this. And he says, "For this reason, he's the mediator of a new covenant." Yeah, well, we're going to say more about that in just a minute. "Since a death has taken place for the redemption." Now, the grammar in the original is very specific. The death is for the redemption. The death is the price of redemption. But he's talking about the death has taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were committed where? Under the first covenant. Okay, and so, and that's a necessary statement for two reasons. Okay? Number one, but not most important, probably, of it's first logically, but it may be of secondary importance. Number one is, he said the Old Testament sacrifices are not adequate. That's necessarily going to raise some questions in the minds of Jewish converts. Okay, so what is that? What about all those people back there? Are you telling us that Abraham and Moses and David are just lost because they were under this integrity? No. No, there's been a sacrifice offered for the redemption of the sins committed under the first covenant. Jesus' sacrifice is efficacious for all time. It's an eternal sacrifice. It's efficacious for all time. So he's their high priest as well as our high priest. He's their sacrifice as well as our sacrifice. Okay, now, the second reason it's necessary for him to say that, and the reason that is really important to his audience, is think about, they're thinking about, considering going back to the Old Testament. Okay. The Hebrew writer has just told them in no uncertain terms. He's anticipated, and this happens inevitably in Hebrews. He will say something, the implications of which he will unpack later on. But in chapter 10, he's going to say, if we go on sinning willfully, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a certain fearful expectation of judgment. Well, that is implicit in this statement. Because if the only sacrifice that can save those people who sinned under the old covenant is Jesus Christ, and you reject that sacrifice, what does that leave for you? Nothing. There no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a certain terrifying expectation of judgment. It's implicit in that, necessarily implicit in the statement he makes here in verse 15. It takes him a while to get there because he's got a lot of other things to do In unpacking the significance of this. But in that one statement that Jesus is an all-time sacrifice, he rules out forever even the thought of going back. Because the only way they... Who is the high priest for the people under the old covenant? Ultimately, Jesus. Who is the sacrifice for the people under the old covenant? Just keep saying Jesus. It's going to be right every time. Okay? I'm only going to ask questions for a few minutes here. I'm only going to ask questions that point to Jesus. Okay, so if they're really going to go back to the old way, in any kind of way that recognizes what God has done, the only thing they go back to is Jesus, which is where they are already. I mean, you can't. There's no place else to go. That's what the Hebrew writer has done at this point in his argumentation. He has said definitively, look, there's no place else to go. Jesus is it. He's the whole thing. And as we move through chapter 9, we're actually going to see, as we crank through some of his argumentation here, I have some vain hope of getting through chapter 9 today. It may not happen, but as we move through this, we're going to see that Jesus actually defies categorization, because he'll say, well, this is a way of looking at it, and they'll come over here and say, but that doesn't quite get it, and this is a way of looking at it, but that doesn't quite get it, and this is a way of looking at it, but that doesn't quite get it. And so, Jesus is the whole thing. And he'll use all these illustrations, but none of them is completely adequate. And so he has to shift, even in the discussion of one thing like covenant. He has to use more than one definition for covenant, because what Jesus has done defies categories. Okay, I'll explain that in a minute, but there's no place else to go. Okay, and that's equally true for us. There's no place else to go. There's not a plan B. Jesus is it. He's the whole thing. You leave him, you left everything. There's not another way. And all of redemptive history from the get-go is declaring that. Not just what is done at the end, but everything has been pointing in that direction from the beginning. Jesus is it. He begins to talk about this, and he says that no covenant is inaugurated without blood. For where a covenant is, there must be of necessity the death of the one who made it. Okay? He talks about this idea in 15 and 16, where he's using the idea of a will. Okay? And part of this, when he talks about covenant, it is to be understood as a will. And when does a will come into effect? When the person dies. Okay? And so he's going to talk about the covenant in terms of a will. We're going to look at Exodus 24 here in just a minute. And so Jesus had to die because that's what brings the covenant into effect. And so in that sense, it's a will. But then he shifts metaphors as he moves on here, and he says, therefore, even the first covenant was not inaugurated without blood. Now he shifted definitions of a covenant, and now he's talking about the relationship that God established with his people as an illustration of this covenant. And here's where he goes back to Exodus 24. So let's go back there just a minute to kind of set this up. Exodus 24, 4 through 8. And so remember sort of the flow of Exodus. Exodus 1 through 18 is the record of Of course, Moses' youth and God calling him and sending him in and the plagues and then God leading the people out. And in Exodus 19, God comes down on Mount Sinai. And then Exodus 20 and following. Exodus 20 is the Ten Commandments, right? Everybody knew that? Everybody knew. I'm sure everybody knew that. Exodus 20 is the Ten Commandments. And then the rest of the law, and that's Exodus 20 through 24. And in chapter 24, the law having been presented to them, the Ten Commandments and the rest of the covenant, they're asked to make a decision. Okay, God gives them the law, so what are you going to do? Okay, and so it says in verse 3, Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has spoken we will do. And so the covenant's presented and they accept it. Now, we know they didn't do it, but that's neither here nor there for our discussion. So they accept the covenant. Moses writes down all the words of the law. Then he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. He sent young men of the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings. Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins. And the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. So he sprinkles blood on the altar. Then in verse 7, he takes the book of the covenant and reads it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all the Lord has spoken, we will do and we will be obedient. That's the second time they've said that. And so he takes blood and sprinkles it on the people and says, behold, the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. And so that covenant is sealed by blood. They have twice affirmed, we will do what the Lord has said. And they are sprinkled with the blood. And then, of course, Moses and some of the priests and the elders go up and they eat in the presence of the Lord in table fellowship, because they've entered into a covenant agreement. Now, this is not a will. This is a covenant between a king and a people. This is more like a suzerainty covenant. Now, anybody know what a suzerainty covenant is? Anybody remember what that is? Somebody want to explain that? Right. So the Hittites, for instance, would conquer a nation, and the Hittite king would come in. The Hittite king would be, because he's the conquering king, he's the suzerain, and then the subject people are called the vassal. That's probably a term we're a little more familiar with, a vassal. And the suzerain would issue a document that basically reviewed his relationship. There's a historical prologue talking about what the king has done, and then he reviews his relationship with the people, and then he gives stipulations of the covenant, general and specific, and then there are blessings and cursings attached to that, and a means for renewing the covenant, which, by the way, is an outline of the book of Deuteronomy, which is given in the form of a suzerainty covenant. It has the same structure as the covenant documents that the Hittites issued in the middle of the second millennium B.C., which is interesting because that's when the Israelites came out of Egypt, in the middle of the second millennium B.C., 1445. And so that was a form they were familiar with. God is their king, and he has made this agreement, this covenant with his people, his subject people. And so is the covenant that Jesus made like a will? Yes. Is it like a suzerainty covenant? Yes. So wait a minute. He's the one who died, and he's the king? How does that work? Oh, well, because of the cross. That's how it works. And so, you see, the Hebrew writer is using two completely different metaphors to illustrate what Jesus has done, because neither one of them is big enough to encompass the whole thing. Because, is Jesus a king? Yes, he is. Did he make a covenant with his people? Yes, he did. But usually, and by usually I mean all the time, except Jesus all the time, usually the king, the suzerain, doesn't die to establish the covenant. That's not usually the way that works. And so that's not an adequate metaphor. And so he brings in this will metaphor that does include the death of the testator, that is, the death of the one making the covenant. And so he has to use a couple of things just to illustrate this one aspect of what Jesus has done. And the reason is because what God has done through Jesus Christ is unprecedented in human experience and history. There's never been anything even remotely like it. And that's why he has to talk about Jesus in terms of a prophet, a priest, a king, better than the angels, better than John. There's no, whatever category you want to bring to the table, it's not big enough to encompass who Jesus is or what he has done. There's a statement in Isaiah 40 in verse 25. It says, "To whom then will you liken me that I would be his equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these stars, the one who leads forth a host by number. He calls them all by name because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one of them is missing." He talks about the stars like sheep following a shepherd. But the point is, there is no one like God. He defies any categorization. And that's the Hebrew writer sort of running up against that problem. And that's why he's piling up these different metaphors. Because, yeah, Jesus is like this, but he's bigger than that. He's like this, but he's bigger than that. It's like, and so, in some way, he's struggling with their lack of spirituality, Hebrews 5 and 6, but he's also struggling with the limitations of human expression and experience. Because none of it is adequate to describe even one aspect of what God has done, much less the whole thing. And so, I want to... We're not here to talk about what the Hebrew writer can't say, obviously. But I think it's important to recognize why he's doing this, because this, what God has done is so big and so amazing that no one metaphor will adequately describe it. And so even in the midst of his discussion of covenant, he has to use a couple of different definitions for covenant, because God does covenant in a way that's bigger than any single thing man has ever done. Okay. Did I lose everybody, or is it still just really early? Okay. All right. We will press on. Now, the other thing that I want to see in this is, he says, "For when every commandment had been spoken," back in Hebrews 9:19, "for when every commandment had been spoken by Moses to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and the goats with the water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, 'This is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you.'" And so he does make this comparison to Moses, but we need to remember a couple of things, okay, about this when he brings this in as a point of comparison. The reason he can do that is because he has already categorically established that, number one, Jesus' covenant is what in comparison with the old covenant? It's superior. That's exactly right. It's superior. Okay? And he made that point in chapter 2. "For this reason, we must pay closer attention to what we have heard so that we do not drift away. For if the word spoken through angels proved unalterable and every transgression and disobedience received a just penalty, how will we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? Which, of course, is a summation of the argument he made in chapter 1 that Jesus is greater than angels and therefore his message is greater than ours. And then in chapter 8, he established that the covenant that Jesus established is greater than the old covenant. He says in verse 6 of chapter 8, now he has obtained a more excellent ministry by as much as he is also the mediator of a better covenant, which has been enacted on better promises. Okay, and then he goes back to Jeremiah 31, 31 to 34, and he talks about this new covenant and how it is superior. And of course, he said that was necessary. And change of priesthood comes to change of the law, Hebrews 7, 12. And so he's already established that this is a better covenant. He's also established that Jesus is superior to Moses, Hebrews 3, 1 through 6. He established that Jesus is superior to Moses inasmuch the builder of the house is superior to the house itself. Jesus is superior to Moses inasmuch a son has a higher position than a servant. Was Moses a faithful servant in God's house? Yes, he was. No knock against Moses. But does a servant have equal status to a son? No, he does not. And so he can use this in chapter 9 as an illustration because he's already demonstrated that Jesus is unspeakably, unimaginably, incomprehensibly greater than Moses and has established a greater and more perfect covenant. And so he's taking these threads, and he's weaving them all together. And then in 23, he goes back to this idea. Again, he's been established many times up to this point. It was necessary for the copies of the things in the heavens to be cleansed with these. With what? With the blood. The sacrifices that were offered. It was necessary that the copies of the things in heaven be cleansed, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. Okay, not, and he's going to go on to point out not sacrifices, but a sacrifice. Okay. For Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, a mere copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. And so Jesus is in the presence of God for us. He stands in the Holy of Holies all the time. Okay? The Levitical priests went into the Holy of Holies, but then they went in and they offered the blood, but then what? They came back out. And then they went in again. They came back out. And again, well, they kept going in because the work, it was not an accomplished fact. It's a reminder of sins year after year. And so he says that, for Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, a mere copy of the true one, but into heaven itself to appear in the presence of God for us. Nor was it that he would offer himself often as the high priest enters the holy place year by year with blood that is not his own. Otherwise, so there are two things, at least, three things, at least. One, Jesus did it one time, they did it often. Two, the Old Testament priest did not offer their own blood, but the blood of a dumb animal. He offered his own blood. Three, they didn't remain in the presence of God. They didn't finish their work. Jesus finished the task, and he stands before the presence of God for all eternity on our behalf. And So he says, otherwise he would need to suffer often since the foundation of the world, but now once at the consummation of the ages, he has been manifest to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. So it's a once for all kind of thing. One time for all kind of thing. And so it is vastly superior. Why would you want to leave that? Now, in 27, he says, inasmuch as it is appointed for men once to die, and after this comes the judgment. And so he plugs us in to something, again, that he said before. It is appointed for men once to die, and then the judgment. Why does he bring up men here? Who's he talking? Who's he been talking about all through here? Okay, he's been talking about animals and Jesus. He's been talking about the Son of God. And now all of a sudden he brings up our experience. It's appointed for men once to die and then the judgment. Why is he? We quote that all the time, I think probably with a studied disregard of the context, but I mean, it's a true statement as it stands. It's appointed for men once to die and then the judgment. That's absolutely true. That's right. It's for men. And that's the point. Go back to Hebrews chapter 2 again, because this is another thread that he's pulling in and weaving into his argument here. He says in Hebrews chapter 2 that God has subjected all things to men. And of course, we know that from Genesis chapter 1, 26 through 28. But he says, we do not yet see all things subjected to men, but we do see him who was made for a little while lower than the angels, namely Jesus. And so Jesus entered into our experience, chapter 2, that he might restore the intended blessings that God had. And so because men die once, Jesus died once. Jesus has entered, and that, of course, that's the very argument he makes here, chapter 2. He says in verse 14, therefore, since children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise also partook of the same, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is the devil. So he's already made this argument. And so here in 9:27, he just touches it. Because clearly, since this is a letter, you just moments earlier read chapter 2, and so you remember all that when you get to chapter 9. Because not only have you just read the letter all the way through, but you've done that hundreds of times, and so it's thoroughly ingrained in your psyche. That's the intent. The Hebrew writer doesn't feel the need to go back and, well, why bring up man in the midst of this discussion of Jesus? Well, I've already made that connection. I made that connection way back at the beginning of the letter. So you're supposed to know that. And so not only is the Hebrew writer interacting with the Old Testament constantly, but also the further you get into the letter, the more he's interacting with things he's already said. And again, chapter 9 is, at least in my mind, is where so many of these threads of thinking begin to be woven together into a single, unbreakable cord that ties them to God's eternal purpose. That is what he is doing there. He is tying back into this already made argument that Jesus entered into our experience. He became man so that, as God, he became man so that he could restore God's intention for men. And it was appointed for men once to die and then the judgment. Jesus died and took the consequences of our sin. He underwent that. He bore the sins of many. So we'll pick up in 9:28. Chapter 10 is not a good chapter break anyway. It's just he just flows on with the argument. And so we'll pick up there next time. Thank you.